University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. H. Bruce Dull, Director of Preventive Medicine Associates of Atlanta, Georgia, speaking on the topic, AIDS and You, Hard Facts and Painful Choices. Dull, Assistant United States Surgeon General from 1977 to 1979, has investigated epidemics of swine flu and Legionnaire's disease, and is currently working with authorities in researching a cure for AIDS. Between 1957 and 1979, he held numerous positions with the United States Public Health Service and Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Since 1982, he has served as president of a private firm consulting in preventive medicine. He is a graduate of Harvard College, Western Reserve University School of Medicine, and the Harvard School of Public Health.
Dr. Bruce Dull is a medical epidemiologist, or a disease detective, if you will. Following undergraduate training in biology at Harvard and medical education at Case Western University, he was one of 14 physicians selected to enter the Epidemic Intelligence Service. This is a unit of the federal government's Center for Disease Control, and it is a training ground for the disease detectives. By now, counting nearly 1,200 graduates of its two-year program, the CDC is internationally known as a world leader in infectious and occupational disease investigations. In more than 25 years as a medical epidemiologist, Dr. Dull has studied a number of well-known health problems, including Legionnaire's disease, the swine flu, and AIDS, as well as those of ongoing domestic and international importance, such as polio, measles, hepatitis, smallpox, and cholera. Dr. Dull prizes his more than 22 vivid years of working at the CDC on infectious diseases, virology, and international and public health administration. Now a consultant in preventive medicine, his field of medical specialization, he continues to teach at the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta and to lecture on one of his favorite topics, the world of disease detection. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Bruce Dull.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here in Lincoln. This is my first visit to Wesleyan, but I had a fringe benefit in spending last evening with a medical school classmate of mine who happens to be here this morning, Dr. Walt Weaver, cardiologist in Lincoln, and it was a very pleasant chance to renew old friendships. I'm very honored to be your lecturer. I've been impressed with the speakers on your forum, and I'm particularly pleased that the committee was interested in having us update our knowledge of AIDS, which many of us believe is already the most important health problem we face in the last half of the century, hopefully not a health crisis, if we can do something to intervene at this point. Most people know something about AIDS, but unfortunately what they know may not be correct. It certainly may not be very enlightened. It may be misleading. It may be unconstructive. In the last few weeks in the Atlanta airport, there's been a new sign. Usually it's held up by a rather stern-looking lady or gentleman, and the sign says, "Quarantine AIDS, mosquitoes don't wear condoms." Well, I saw it yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I wanted to start a friendly debate, but I knew I'd get no place. Their minds were already made up, and really it's far more important that we talk about it, because the future of the epidemic is in your hands and the hands of people you influence, and certainly not theirs. Let me explain at the beginning that what I'm going to do will probably seem to many of you who are reasonably expert in AIDS like a very basic approach. But so we can talk in our follow-up session, I want to make sure that we all have at least the same basic information. The millions of people who know about AIDS share one sentiment, unfortunately. It boils down to something like this, although they may say it differently. It's you know, that AIDS really sounds like a terrible problem. I'm certainly glad it's not one of mine. If that sounds familiar, or if you share that feeling, I hope I can maybe begin to dissuade you, because there's no doubt in my mind that AIDS is everybody's problem, even if it's only paying the bill for the epidemic. To think about AIDS, for me at least, it's a little bit easier if we think about the diseases of AIDS, and the epidemic of AIDS as being distinctive. Ever since 1982, the diseases of AIDS have been an ever-expanding collection of illnesses of an invariably fatal kind, which all relate to a virus infection which does a number of things because it infects essentially all the organ systems of the body. On the other hand, the epidemic of AIDS is, of course, the cases, but it's everything else that goes along with the cases: the misinformation, the misunderstandings, the stigmatization, the prejudice, maybe even the panic that's bound to be part of anything as mysterious and new as a disease that is lethal. I'm sorry that the tone of this is so somber, and if I had been in your place having a topic like AIDS and a speaker named Dull, I'm not sure I would have come. Although it's better than it used to be, because when I was at the Center for Disease Control for, I guess it was 23 years altogether, one of my colleagues, an epidemiologist, who is still a professor of epidemiology at Emory University, and I used to talk on the same programs, his name is John Boring. And the introducer invariably felt compelled to say, "This morning, ladies and gentlemen, your speakers are dull and boring." And then he would go on and say, when another friend of ours joined us, whose name was John Witte, another epidemiologist, he'd say, "But fortunately, we also have Witte with us. You're to be congratulated for getting over that barrier." Let me tell you why I think AIDS is important and maybe the most important health problem we have, certainly in public health. It shares with truly important problems three major characteristics. First, its cost in terms of lives, in terms of dollars. Secondly, its scope. How long will it last? How many people ultimately will be involved? What will be the extent, geographic, of this problem? And finally, the impact it has, not only on the cases and on the healthcare system, but also on everybody in the population. AIDS has all these characteristics and quite a few more. So far, since 1981, when AIDS was first discovered, or first identified, suspected, there have been more than 45,000 cases of the disease reported. Undoubtedly, that's at least a 20% under-reporting, but we're not really sure. It's expected that by now there are 1.5 to 2 million people infected with the AIDS virus. We do know that of those 45,000 cases, 26,000 have already died. Internationally, it's imagined, because much of the reporting internationally is really very, very poor, and only 20 or 22,000 cases have been identified. There are lots more, but it's estimated that at least 10 million people are now infected. But what concerns most of us is what the projections are for the future. By the end of 1991, when the first decade of the AIDS era has ended, in this country it's expected that we will have had altogether in those 10 years 270,000 cases, about 175,000 deaths, two-thirds of them. And if we can't do something now to interrupt transmission, we may have between 10 and 12 million infected persons. Worldwide, by that time, by the end of 1991, there will probably have been 3 million cases, and between 50 million and 100 million people will be infected. These are staggering numbers. AIDS is going to become much more real to us all in the next few years as the numbers begin to mount, and as we all know people, or we know about people in our own environments who are ill with this disease. But there are lots of other things that are happening. Our language is changing. The Random House Dictionary of the American Language came out fairly recently and included AZT, azidothymidine, which is currently our only licensed drug for treating AIDS. But a word that's even much more common now is condom, a word that just a few years ago wasn't even used in polite society. Now it's almost dinner table conversation, mainly about whether it's a male or a female responsibility to have them available. I was told about 2 5-year-old boys on their way into kindergarten. One said to the other one, "Guess what? I found a condom on the veranda." And the other little boy thought and said, "What's a veranda?" Almost every day, at least in Atlanta, we read in the newspapers about the AIDS epidemic. Either AIDS discrimination or stigmatization in housing, schools, workplace, families, medical care, questions about whether people should be tested with the serological tests available for AIDS. If so, would there be confidentiality and privacy assured? What about the adequacy of the research budget for AIDS? Who's looking after some of these problems? Should there be condom dispensers in college dormitories or sold in the bookstores? What about AIDS and family values? Should we teach children in grade school sexuality, or should we teach them morality? What about sexual frankness as a part of dating? All these questions have never confronted us either in the same depth or certainly with the same importance. But maybe most importantly, the disease of AIDS and the epidemic of AIDS are having an almost unbelievable effect in cities where there are large numbers of cases, and certainly on the cases themselves, on PWAs, persons with AIDS, as the patients want to be called. As you can imagine, coming down with AIDS means having about the same time to face dying, to admitting to homosexuality, drug abuse, or some other socially rejected behavior, to risk losing a job, housing, health insurance, sometimes family, comfort, compassion, friends. And despite the fact that people internationally, certainly in this country, know a lot about AIDS, there's an indifference to or a neglect of PWAs. There was a survey done in the Los Angeles Times, or by the Los Angeles Times, in December 1986, in which more than 50% of the people they surveyed said they thought it was quite appropriate to include quarantine as one of the interventions in AIDS, totally missing the point that for every case of AIDS, there are probably 50 infections unknown to the people who are infected, people who are quite able and who, in fact, are the ones currently spreading the virus. Just the idea of AIDS usually first evokes a question about lifestyle and not really concern about the fact that there are sick and dying people. AIDS has almost become the metaphor for evil and sin rather than the concept of disease and health. And this is particularly tragic because our only weapon against AIDS, both the disease and the epidemic, is knowledge. And if we are confronting people whose prejudices, whose personal concerns, whose inability to deal with some of the issues that have to be considered is such that even facts don't impinge on them, let alone knowledge and certainly not wisdom, we have an uphill fight. Another reason I think AIDS is particularly important is because it's clearly preventable in a very fundamental and almost primitive way, but still preventable. Those of us who specialize in preventive medicine like to think at least that we aim toward keeping people well and, in fact, persuading them even to become healthier, to optimize their well-being. But as simple as that sounds, getting most people to do what is good for them in terms of their health is a tall order. I know how long it took me to use seatbelts without being reminded every time. Preventive medicine is a lot more likely to be effective when people begin to sense their own vulnerability to a problem and to realize that not to do something about this problem, which may affect them, is absolutely senseless. But until that time, until the light of self-awareness comes on and something says, wait a minute, you could be in that picture too, until that happens, not much else is going to occur, particularly with respect to behavior changes of the kinds we're talking about. What I'd like to try to do at this point is to draw a picture of AIDS for you, both the disease and the epidemic, and I'd like to do it in three parts. I'd like to describe the history of the epidemic, the current status of the epidemic, and also what we expect to happen in the next 3 or 4 years. And I'd like to do it in an epidemiologic framework, which is a very natural way for me to approach a problem, since since I started out my public health training as an epidemiologist. But I need to tell you what epidemiologists are and do, and maybe one of the simplest ways is to say epidemiologists are concerned about epidemics. But what is an epidemic? The word gives us a clue, a pretty good one, as a matter of fact, because epidemic comes from two Greek roots, epi, meaning on or among, and demos, meaning people, something that is occurring on or among people, in this case, a disease or diseases of AIDS, not occurring in a person, but on or among people. Medical doctors, general practitioners, family physicians usually work with one patient at a time. Epidemiologists work with groups of people. The groups could be anything from all the people who live in a given neighborhood or residence hall or state or city or nation, or they could be grouped differently. They could be all NFL coaches or all millionaires or all Lutherans or all 25-year-olds or all wife swappers. You're getting the point. It's some identifiable, unifying characteristic which holds the group together. And the reason this is so important for epidemiologists is because it does suggest associations and it suggests risks, risks characteristic to a group. Epidemiologists, by working with groups, have had to figure out ways to describe what's going on in the group, and they do this with numbers and rates and statistical tests and charts and graphs. And they use them, the tools of their trades, much as a family doctor would use a stethoscope or an X-ray or a physical examination. In a way, epidemiologists are sort of the doctors, the diagnosticians of community diseases, just as other physicians are the diagnosticians of individual diseases. Well, most of us, not only epidemiologists, have a natural inclination toward detection. You know, what's going on? Why does this seem unusual? Things are not quite right here. We need to investigate this event. And it was that kind of impulse, in a sense, or that kind of reasoning back in 1981 that led the first few doctors who saw cases of this bizarre disease that came to be known as AIDS, the reason that they began to suspect something was wrong, something was happening. In fact, it was just before Christmas in 1980 when a Dr. Michael Gottlieb, an immunologist at the University of California School of Medicine in Los Angeles, was asked to see a patient on referral. I think all of you know what immunologists are, people who deal with the immune system and the defense mechanisms of the body. The patient that Dr. Gottlieb was asked to see was a 33-year-old man. We can call him Fred, just for convenience. And Fred had been in good health until just a few months before he was seen by Dr. Gottlieb back in September, October of 1980, when he rather suddenly came down with fever and night sweats, weight loss, and a condition which generally suggested to his own doctor that he might have leukemia because his white blood count was unusual and because he was increasingly unable to fight off infections, something fairly characteristic of leukemia and other bloodborne problems of that kind. When Dr. Gottlieb saw him, it was because, in fact, he had an infection which Fred could not manage and his doctor couldn't manage. He had something called thrush, which is technically known as candidiasis, a yeast infection, in this case of his mouth and throat, a condition which is not uncommon at all in newborn infants because their immune systems are so immature that they're unable to fight off this yeast infection. Fred's yeast infection was treated, but in the course of studying what was wrong, some clues came to light, and one of the major ones was that Fred's blood contained almost none of a very important white blood cell involved in the immune process, a white blood cell called a T helper lymphocyte, which you may have read about. Fred was sent home, the thrush having been treated fairly successfully, but over the next few months he did poorly And he came back to the hospital a few months later with a severe pneumonia. And if somebody can switch the slides on, we'll take a look at Fred's pneumonia. Most doctors feel they have to show a medical slide or two just to live up to the fact that they have a medical degree, and so let me do it. But I do it for another reason, not just to show you where the heart and lungs and the diaphragms are, but or to show you that this hazy area above both of the diaphragms is, in fact, if we turn all those out, I won't be able to see my notes. That's the only problem. I hope you can see it reasonably well. Some of the other slides are a little bit better. The reason I show it to you is that... That's good. Thank you. I can still see it. The reason I show it to you is because this pneumonia was very unusual in that it was caused by an organism known as Pneumocystis carinii. Now, Pneumocystis carinii is a protozoan, a parasite, which does cause pneumonia and had previously because Dr. Gottlieb and many other doctors had seen it. It's a disease which generally is seen in people whose immune systems are deficient because they were born with immune deficiency or because they're being treated with drugs to suppress their rejecting organs that are transplanted, organs like kidneys and hearts. But why did Fred have immune deficiency and why did he have Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, which became known as PCP, initials that you might remember? And as we'll see later, it turns out that more than 50% of cases of AIDS come to the doctor with Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, particularly heterosexuals who have AIDS. Well, why did he have it? No one was quite sure. He was treated with a drug specific for this disease, but he did not do well. And within a few weeks, he developed more serious infections. And by May 1981, Fred died. What stimulated an epidemiologic investigation was that Dr. Gottlieb got the feeling that things weren't quite right here when he saw two more cases of Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia with immune deficiency in young men. Was this a coincidence or was something going on? He was very curious when he took a careful history and he learned that all three of these people, a 33-year-old and two 30-year-olds, were all gay. The only thing they had in common. They didn't know each other. They came from different parts of the Los Angeles area. And Dr. Gottlieb said, is this the tip of some epidemic iceberg? He called the Los Angeles County Health Department. They had not seen any cases like this, but it took them only a few hours and a few telephone calls to turn up two more cases. In June 1981, the Center for Disease Control published a report of these first five cases of Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in gay men with immune deficiency from the Los Angeles County area. And within days and a few weeks, a number of other cases began to be reported from many other parts of the country. One of the most important of those reports was one from New York City, in which 26 cases of a very rare skin cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma, some of these people also had PCP, and all of the 26 cases were in gay men with immune deficiency. 20 of them from New York, 6 of them from California. What was going on? Were these related, PCP and Kaposi's sarcoma, KS? And this is what Kaposi's sarcoma often looks like when it begins. This is someone's heel, and you'll notice reddish, purplish, raised blotches on the skin. In the course of this disease, these skin cancers cover the entire body, may invade the internal organs, and usually are associated with other severe infections like Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia and others, and ultimately lead to death. Here were two conditions. Was this part of the same iceberg, or was this something different? Back in 1981 and early 82, when all this was happening, what was being visualized was just the tip of what then was totally impossible to imagine, and that is that under the surface, unknown, were many, many times the numbers of cases of PCP and KS being seen, cases which eventually would come to light as additional problems associated with the same syndrome. Well, it became quite confusing over the next months because dozens and then hundreds of cases of immune deficiency in gay men, along with what became known as opportunistic infections and cancers, things which otherwise would not have occurred but did because of the immune deficiency. And to give you some idea of what these began looking like, here's a partial listing, and I don't expect you to look at these in particular, but merely notice that over the next months, diseases were noted of the central nervous system, a variety of infections of the GI tract, including the esophagus. Here's Candida, the name I mentioned to you, Kaposi's sarcoma, and other neoplasms, other cancers, lymphomas. Here's pneumocystis, virus diseases of the lungs, as well as parasites, carcinoma, anal carcinoma, disseminated vascular and hematologic problems, an unknown and continuing to be unfolding series of diseases associated with the same condition. Well, to help epidemiologists and clinicians sort through all of this, a case definition of what AIDS is, the one I gave you originally, immune deficiency coupled with opportunistic infections and other conditions which seem to be acquired in some peculiar way, but representing a collection or an assortment of illnesses, a syndrome. And in September 1982, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome was named and determines what we now count as that particular disease. Well, it became evident about that time, and had been for a few months before that, that seemingly everybody with this condition was gay. In fact, for a while, this was known as gay immune deficiency disease, GRID. Some of you may even remember that. But it very quickly became apparent that the only group that people were recognizing initially was not the only group that was involved. Other epidemiologically definable groups seemed to have the same disease. The second largest group were people who abused intravenous drugs and shared intravenous injection equipment. There were also cases seen in people who had received blood transfusions and blood fractions, for example, hemophiliacs, which suggested that in some way blood was containing something which was being transmitted. And it was also noted that mothers were seemingly able to transmit this illness to their infants if they, in fact, were infected. And there were cases in men and women who had been sex partners of cases of this disease. In fact, it was possible to trace the spread among some clusters of sex partners. Very interesting that at that time it seemed as if some infectious agent was probably being transmitted in three ways. There was no infectious agent known at that time, but three ways were clearly sexually, homosexual, bisexual behavior, but also seemingly heterosexual behavior, by blood that was either contaminating intravenous injection equipment or given as part of transfusions or medical care, and thirdly, mothers to infants. And very interestingly, and I think a tribute to the epidemiologists, is that even now, knowing the virus, having better tests for it, there have not been determined to be any additional routes of transmission except those three. Obviously, the most important discovery of the next year or two was that indeed this was caused by an infectious agent, a virus, an unusual virus, a retrovirus. And if you look at these cells in culture, you'll see on the surface some projections and some irregularities. These are the viruses, the retroviruses that cause the disease that are being produced in those cells and being extruded, being pushed out, so that in the circulation they will then infect additional cells. In cross-section, this virus looks something like this. It has an envelope made of protein primarily, but it has an ingredient in the genetic framework of the disease, an enzyme actually called reverse transcriptase, a name you may have heard about or a word you may have heard, and that's the enzyme which allows some of the genetic metabolism of this cell of this virus to move in the reverse direction of all other viruses, thus called a retrovirus. I also show you this because it's known that the protein coating of this virus mutates, that means changes its characteristics, so that a vaccine against some elements of this virus would be expected to be relatively ineffective, and virologists are looking for the stable components of the virus so that they can create either drugs to treat them or vaccines against the virus. When the virus was discovered in France in 1983 and in the U.S. in 1984, it was given various names. Some of these you've seen, HTLV-3, LAV, ARV, but in 1986, by consensus, it became known as the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. And I'll try to use that term, although if I slip, you think HIV, because HIV infection is what we're talking about. AIDS is a clinical manifestation of this infection, but the infection, the epidemic of HIV, is what we're really, really concerned about. Within a year of having the virus in hand, it became possible to develop a serological test to demonstrate infection. And let me use this slide to point out a couple things which we've learned. One is that shortly after being infected, virus is apparent in the bloodstream, but seemingly then disappears when it is incorporated into the nucleus of cells and in a sense goes underground, but is still present and is still infectious. While it's present reasonably early on, antibodies, the proteins that are created in response to a foreign body in the human being, antibodies are formed which persist as long as the virus is present. And the presence of antibody is an indirect measure of the fact that virus is present, and it appears that once infected, virus is present for life, as is infectivity. We've learned a lot of additional things, and one is the slowness, if you will, of this viral infection process. Once infected with HIV, about 35% of people will come down with AIDS, as I've described it, the classic definition, within about 4 to 5 years. We haven't had the virus around very long, so we can't really project much beyond that period of time, but it looks as if that is the minimum who will come down with the major form of the disease. An additional 20 or 25% come down with something less serious, something called ARC, AIDS-related complex, a series of illnesses which do not seem to be life-threatening, but it does also turn out that some of those cases ultimately will become more severe and will become full-blown AIDS. On the more hopeful side, it seems that many people, at least half and perhaps more, who come down with HIV infection will not develop essentially any disease, and their life expectancy may be normal. But unfortunately, it has not been long enough that this virus has been around that we can be absolutely sure. We are quite sure, however, that this virus, this HIV infection, is not particularly communicable. It certainly is not communicable by casual contact of the kind that people would have in school or in households or in the workplace. It seems to be only communicable in the three ways I told you about. Even in healthcare setting, hospitals and clinics, the usual infectious disease infection containment procedures seem to be quite adequate to cut down almost totally the risk of spreading this virus. With the blood test and the virus in hand, research looking for cures and looking for treatments have been surprisingly successful in a very short period of time. And there is the one drug I mentioned to you already licensed, AZT, which although not 100% effective and not able to be taken by everyone, for those who can take it and don't have any side effects, it provides a way to reduce the amount of virus multiplication they experience, to give them a chance to recover some of their immune function, and to give them a much more normal outlook, at least temporarily, on their lives. Research on vaccines is making a lot of progress, particularly at basic levels of virology. But because this is a new and unusual virus, the expectations for a workable vaccine puts the timetable somewhere in the next decade, perhaps even at the beginning of the next century. Most scientists feel that the effort should be put now into developing drugs to treat and ideally to cure. Well, in the next few minutes, I want to give you some status report on the epidemic. Where are we? And what can we expect in the future? And then, if we have some time left, even before we have our discussion at 11 o'clock, we may want to talk something about what are we going to do about all this. But let me show you where we are. Here is the so-called epidemic curve that epidemiologists talk about. It's a listing of the reported cases, which in AIDS became reported on a regular basis back in 1981. This shows reported cases by six-month periods, and you'll notice that this 1987 last half of the year only includes 2 months, and we expect that by the end of the year this chart will show a bar about that high. But very important to notice here is that the blue segments, which represent the fatalities, appear to be declining, largely the result of the fact that once reported, it takes 1 to 3 years for the disease to progress to the point of death. Let me point out a few other things that we think are quite important. Between 1981 and 82, the increase in number of cases was more than 250%. Since that time, the rate of increase has been declining to the point that between 85 and 86, there were only 55% more cases. Will that continue to happen, or will we now begin to see an increase as the disease spreads more and more widely? A few other things I want to point out that are important because we're really trying to characterize the groups. Remember, the group that has these diseases. 93% of these cases are men. Only 7% are female. 68% of these cases are between the ages of 20 and 39. Thus, we already see that this is a disease of young adult men, primarily. 31% of them are age 40 and over, and only 1 to 2% are less than age 19. But remember that if we have cases coming down at age 20, they were infected when they were 15 and 16. So that don't be misled by when the case occurred. Remember, we have a long incubation period disease here. Very important also to note the fact that 61% of these cases are white, 25% are black, 14% are Hispanic. Those latter two categories are doubly represented among cases. There are only about half that number in our population. Why so many blacks? Why so many Hispanics? Epidemiologists have found that the black and Hispanic cases are largely cases in major urban areas where there is a good deal of drug abuse, and these represent cases of bloodborne AIDS transmitted by intravenous injection equipment that was shared. Let's go on. We're defining groups, and this chart shows the groups that now have the disease. You'll notice that the yellow homosexual, bisexual men plus homosexuals who use drugs represent about 75% of the cases. Thus, much of the reservoir of the virus is in this population. Let's go on. The next turquoise-colored block are intravenous drug users, a few hemophiliacs, a group of heterosexuals which primarily represent females, female sex partners of cases of AIDS, either acquired through homosexual contact or through intravenous drug abuse, and some transfusion recipients, and then a few undetermined, largely because they had died prior to the time it was possible to get a careful history of how they might have been infected. This represents currently, where the virus is primarily located. It certainly doesn't give us a clear indication where it also may be, but epidemiologically, these are the foci from which the virus is spreading. Now, where is AIDS occurring? It's occurring in all states. But if you'll notice the red-colored ones, which have the most cases reported so far, if one puts New York, New Jersey, Florida, Texas, and California together, one accounts for about 70% of the cases. Illinois is the next in line. Nebraska has fewer than 50 cases, but it's known that, as I mentioned, for every case there's an approximately 50 additional infections that are associated not necessarily with that case, but certainly associated with the epidemic. This also is changing. Worldwide, more than 100 countries have reported AIDS, and don't believe the fact that there's none in the USSR. They have decided there are 50 cases that were imported. None have occurred there because there is no homosexuality or drug abuse, we're told. Most of the cases, other than in the United States, although, as you see, they're widespread, most of the cases are in Central Africa, where many people believe the virus was transferred from the monkey population to the human population, probably through monkey bites or through rituals, blood rituals using monkey blood. This may have happened a number of times, and we can talk about that later if you wish. But just notice how widespread. This is what, in the Greek root, pan, meaning everywhere, would lead us to call it a pandemic, everywhere among people. Well, what's going to happen in the future? What's going to happen in the next few years, knowing what we do about AIDS? In 1986, the Public Health Service assembled 85 or 90 experts in AIDS from all over the world, said, using all the information you have, making assumptions, using estimates, tell us what is going to happen so we can begin to plan for medical care, we can begin to plan for our research effort. And the experts made several assumptions. They said, well, we have to decide how many people in these high-risk groups there are and how many of them now are infected. And they made the estimate that there are 2.5 million active, full-time, if you will, exclusively homosexual men in the country. There are between 5 and 10 million bisexual men. There are 1.5 million intravenous drug abusers, about half of them who inject drugs more than once weekly. And they knew from surveys about what proportion of those groups were already infected in 1986, and they've come up with a projection, which is this. What I've shown you so far is this portion of the epidemic, up to 1986. Since that time, this yellow portion are estimates, but you'll notice that the orange tops on those bars are the actual additional cases that were reported, suggesting that their curve is probably on target, at least so far. Well, what lies behind, and what do these numbers represent? I told you that by 1991, this total would be about 270,000, of which 175,000 would represent fatal cases. But more importantly, I think, for us as epidemiologists, and I include all of you now in that category, is the fact that there will be some changes. Instead of there being 93% of the cases in men, that will decline by 1991 to 89% as more females become infected as a result of sexual contact or intravenous drug abuse, and infants are born as a result of prenatal or perinatal infection with the virus. But a change that I want to point out to you that I think is particularly important is that although the numbers are not large, what now represents about 4 or 5% of the total, that's heterosexually transmitted disease, will increase to about 10%. Still not the majority by any means, but a rate of change doubling within 4 or 5 years. And it's the implication, it's the trend that I think we have to think about. Another thing I want to point out to you is that in 1983, nearly 50% of all the cases could be accounted for in cases that were reported from New York City and San Francisco, two cities. By 1991, those two cities will be contributing only 20% of the cases. In 1983, somewhat over half the cases in the country were coming from places other than New York City and San Francisco. In 1991, 80% of the cases will be coming from parts of the country other than those two cities. This means that the epidemics on the two coasts in our major urban areas with large gay populations and large drug-abusing populations will have a declining epidemic, but that the epidemic will be increasing in other parts of the country, very characteristic of epidemic theory, which has to do with the transmission of infectious agents. And the last thing I want to say about this chart, and then I want to make one or two comments before we end, the last thing I want to say is there's not much we can do about it. These cases are already infected, and it's just a matter of waiting until they come down with AIDS or with some of the other diseases. The number of infections that are being spread at this time, in 1987, 88, 89, will determine what's happening in 1992, 3, 4, 5, and onward. Will this curve continue up? Will it turn over? And that will be determined entirely by whether we're able, with our reasonably primitive approach of trying to persuade people who may be at high risk, who may encounter this virus, to avoid it, to prevent spread by not becoming infected. And I think we can turn the lights back on, because I just want to say one or two additional things. I don't want to moralize, and I don't want to get overly philosophical, but I want to repeat three things for you that everybody should know, and they're straightforward, and I think you know them. Whether you believe them is the question. The first is that the AIDS epidemic is real. It is not going to go away. It's going to get much worse, and everybody is going to know someone or know about someone who is affected. The second thing is that we know how the virus spreads. We know that the only intervention we have, if you will, is not getting exposed to it. We know that it spreads sexually, men to men, women to men, men to women, primarily by infective sexual secretions, semen, vaginal fluid. We know that their infectivity varies from time to time, but we know that generally those fluids are infective in people who are infected with HIV, the virus. We know that there are some behaviors and some additional risk factors. We know that almost all the cases of AIDS in men have perhaps been transmitted by receptive anal intercourse. The lower GI tract seems to be unable to resist infection with this virus. We also know that multiple sex partners, just like Russian roulette, increases the chance of being exposed to the virus. We know the virus spreads by blood. Fortunately, screening of the blood supply has rendered the blood essentially totally safe. If there is infection, it's in the neighborhood of one infective unit per hundreds of thousands of units to be given. Most of the spread, therefore, will not be through blood or blood fractions, fragments such as those given to hemophiliacs, but rather by contamination of intravenous drug equipment, or by those rare events in hospitals where a contaminated needle might be stuck in the finger of a healthcare worker. Fortunately, tremendously rare, and not a major problem, certainly one that has to be considered, but in terms of the total epidemic, not that important. Finally, from mothers who were infected to their infants, either before they're born or at the time the infants are born by being contaminated with infected blood, or perhaps by there being infective breast milk, which, because of the immune system being fairly immature in infants, can infect, it would seem. And the last thing, that we know how the disease is spread, we know the epidemic is here, and the last thing is we know that our job is to lead all of us in some way to personalize the epidemic. Whether or not we are at risk of the disease, we're clearly at risk of the epidemic, because I didn't tell you, but now let me tell you what the cost of that 1991 experience will be. The cases that occur that year will cost between $8 and $10 billion to treat. Hospitalization, medical care, the research that goes on around those cases, screening of blood, and the rest will cost another $2 billion. But what is lost to the economy in terms of that number of ill people, that number of people who have died, will be about $60 billion. money which has to be made up somehow by the rest of us. So we're all going to be paying the bill. We need to know about the epidemic, the disease, to protect ourselves, whether we abstain from possible contact or whether we protect ourselves as best we can. We need to recognize that our importance in making sound decisions and sound policies will involve us. The terror, the fear, the prejudice, stigmatization that goes along with this epidemic and with this disease will result in all of us having to take some stand on what is reasonable. We know it's not very infective. We know that it tends to be feared far more than it probably should, but we know that it takes knowledge and certainly takes wisdom in order that we're going to be able to manage it successfully. Thank you very much.
Today, University Forum has presented Dr. H. Bruce Dull, Director of Preventive Medicine Associates of Atlanta, Georgia. He spoke on the topic, AIDS and You, Hard Facts and Painful Choices. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.